we had seen how the Jews were led by Devorah and Barak, and the Jews repented, and there was quiet for 40 years. The Jews start sinning again, and Hashem gives them in the hands of the Midianites. Now the Midianites are really offsprings of Avram Avinu. The Midian was a person who was Avram's son. Midian ve'efa v'chanoch v'avida v'elda kolele b'nei Keturah. Avram had children from Keturah. Now one of the children he had from Keturah was named Midian. And Midian procreated, and he had many, many children, and he became a people called the Midianites. Now the Midianites lived in tents, they were nomads, and they were great in numbers, and they were neighbors to Amalek. They lived pretty close by. So the Midianites attack from the east, and they overtake us, and we're under the Midianite rule for 7 years. And the Jews see that every time they try planting things, the Midianites come and take all their crops and take all their cattle. So they start making caves and different enclaves in the mountaintops where they could hide their produce. Because anytime they'd plant, the Midianites would get all their cousins, all the different nomadic tribes, the tribes of the east, which are really our cousins. I mean, they come from Abraham and we come from Abraham. And they'd gather Amalek, which was also a great, great, great grandson of Avram. We know Amalek was Esav's grandson. Yishmael is also Avram's son, right? So they'd all gather and they'd come and destroy everything we planted. They'd bring their animals and destroy everything. They'd take all our animals, all our crops, and they'd just destroy. Now they came with huge numbers and the Jews couldn't stand up to them. Now God sent a prophet, God sent Pinchas, and he told them, you know, I took you out of Egypt, I saved you from the Mitzrayim, I saved you from those that oppressed you, I chased the people out of the land, and I told you, don't serve the idols of the people of Israel, the Emori gods, and you're not listening to me. So God basically was telling them, guys, because of what you've been doing, that's what you're suffering. And if there's one point that we have to learn from Tanakh, it is we have to learn to get perspective on current events. The Tanakh teaches us that things don't just happen. God is causing them to happen. A dog barks at the stick that's hitting it. An intelligent person has to see who's holding the stick that's hitting it. So when the Midianites attacked, the Jews might have said, well, we should have better fortification, we should have made peace treaties, we should have made pacts with other nations, we should have gotten better weapons. And God says, no, that's not the point. Because of your averos, because you haven't lived up to your responsibilities to the Torah, that's why you're suffering at the hands of the Midianites. So 7 years we're suffering under the Midianites, and then a Malach comes to Gidon, and Gidon, he's the son of Yoash, and they live on the eastern side of the Jordan, and Gidon is trying to thresh wheat to hide from the Midianites, and this angel appears to him and tells him, God is with you, you young, strong soldier. And Gidon says, if God is with us, so then why are we in such a state that I have to go hide whatever wheat we plant? And last night was Pesach. My father sat me at the Seder, told me everything about the great things that God took us out of Mitzrayim. And where are all these miracles? We have heard all of these miracles. Why don't we see them now? If our forefathers were righteous that God took them out of Egypt, so God should save us now in their merits. And if they were wicked, so just like God saved them though they were wicked, God should save us, even if we're not living up to what we should be doing. So the angel tells him, you spoke well. In that one speech where you spoke that you have a claim that God should really help the Jewish people, that changed the tide in heaven. That's the strength with which you will win and overcome against the Midianites. I'm sending you, go. So Gidon says, excuse me, sir, but how am I going to save them? My family is my grouping. My father is a group. The tribe is divided into thousands. and we are considered the weakest thousand, and I am the youngest in my father's house. So how exactly am I going to lead the Jewish people? And God tells him, because I will be with you, and you're going to destroy the Midianites. The people will listen to you, and it'll go quickly. 1, 2, 3, you'll destroy them. So Gideon says, you know what? Please, give me a sign that I know that you're really an angel that you're talking to me, because Gideon was not accustomed to prophecy. And here there's a question how to understand these verses. One point that the Rambam makes is that a prophet never doubts his prophecy. Another point that the Rambam makes is that angels never take on corporal form. Angels are always spiritual. They are seen with our neshama. They are never seen with the eye. You don't see them physically. The Ramban disagrees, and other commentaries disagree. And over here, the question is, what was Gideon asking? The simple understanding is, he wasn't sure if he was talking to an angel or not. And he wanted proof. That doesn't work with the Rambam. The Rambam is going to have to explain this whole story differently. The Rambam is going to have to explain that he wanted proof that God was really sending him to do this and that he'd be successful. And the Rambam is going to have to explain this whole parasha differently. We're reading this not according to the Rambam. Yeah. Good question. That's exactly where the Ramban takes him to test. The beginning of Parashas Vayera. Right. That's where you look in the Ramban, and if you want to see the Rambam, what the Rambam might answer the Ramban, you could see the Radak over there. The Radak, Rav David Kimchi, fights back for the Rambam. He explains that the Rambam would explain all the Ramban's questions. The Ramban asks from the story of Avram and the three angels in the beginning of the Yera. He asks, how was Yaakov fighting an angel? If they don't take on corporeal form, what's going on? And he's limping after the fight, so he can't tell me it was all a vision. So the Ramban has a list of questions, and the Radak over there answers many of them. So, and we can answer them. Before I saw the Radak, I thought of the answers. So it's good answers, but I think that they're answers that you could answer too. It's always nicer to see that a Rishon answered them. Okay, so we're continuing here. I'm just pointing out that the way we're learning Pshat, but we have to know that the Rambam is going to have to learn this whole story differently. We're learning simply like a guy showed up and he's not sure, are you an angel or not? There's no way that fits with the Rambam. So, but being that we're just learning this for the first time, so we're going to have to stick to a simple understanding. So the Rambam says, a separate point that the Rambam says is that a prophet never doubts the truth of his prophecy. A prophet knows right away. So the Rambam says not that way. The Rambam says it can't be that a prophet ever has doubt in his own prophecy. It must be as clear as his own existence that he knows God spoke to me, and this is exactly what he said. For if there were any room for doubt, says the Rambam, how could Avram ever take his son to slaughter him? He had to think, maybe it was a dream, maybe I was hallucinating, maybe he was going insane, who knows? But how could the kindest of people take his son to slaughter him if he wasn't 100% sure that it was God who told him to do so? So that's how the Rambam understands one of the messages of the Akedah. So, okay, we're not learning with the Rambam here. We're going with Pashup Chah. So Gideon asks, please make me a sign that you are talking to me. For those of you, if you're looking for where we're holding, we're in Shoftim, the 6th chapter, the 18th verse. So please, wait, I'll bring an offering, I'll place it before you. And the angel says, I'm waiting, I'm not going anywhere. So Gideon comes, and he slaughters a goat, and he takes matzah, and he puts everything together with the gravy, and he brings it under the tree. And the angel says, take the meat and the matzah and put it on the stone over there and pour the gravy over it. And then the angel extends his staff and he touches the meat and the matzah, and the fire comes up from the rock and consumes all of it, and the angel disappears. So Gideon recognizes this is an angel, and he says, wow, I saw an angel face to face. And Hashem speaks to him in prophecy and says, peace to you, don't worry, you're not going to die. So Gideon erects an altar over there, and over there he declares, Hashem is Shalom. From here we derive the concept that God's name is Shalom. When we say Shalom Aleichem, peace be with you, what we're really saying is, may God be with you, God whose name is Shalom. It was a rabbinic institution that we greet our fellow man with God's name of Shalom. And that's why some say we shouldn't say the word Shalom in the bathroom. That's why some people get accustomed to saying shulim. Or so that way if someone in the bathroom greets you, you don't end up saying God's name. So over here, Gidon declares God's name is Shalom, and on that altar he declares it. And that night, God tells him, take the two oxen that you have, your father has left, and go to the center of town where your father has a special altar for the Baal, and he has a special tree that's also for idol worship, an Asherah tree. Cut down the tree and destroy the altar for the Baal, for this pagan god called Baal, and erect an altar for God over here by this rock where the angel accepted the sacrifice. And then you take one of the cows and you bring it as a sacrifice for God, and you burn the sacrifice with the wood from the Asherah tree, from this other idol that's made of wood. So Gidon, he on the one hand has to be Kiddush Hashem, on the other hand he's scared of doing it by day, so he takes 10 servants and he goes, and he's scared of his father's family and he's scared of the people in the city. So he does what God told him. He destroys the altar, he cuts down the tree, and the people wake up in the morning and they come to their altar. They come and they find that their altar has been destroyed, and their pagan, their god, has also been cut down. And they see that a special cow, the one cow in the city that they were still raising to bring before this god, and they see that it's been sacrificed on a new altar that's been erected. So they question what's been going on, and they find out that Gidon, the son of Yoash, did this. Now remember, who owned the altar initially for idol worship? Gidon's father, Yoash. Who owned the Asherah tree, this idol? His father. So now the people of the city come and they say, give us over your son, we want to kill him. He destroyed the altar and the idol. And Yoash says, well, you have to fight for the gods. Let the gods fight their own fight. Anyone who fights with my son, I'll kill him by morning. If the Baal is really a god, he will fight my son, because my son destroyed his altar. And on that name, his father named him, instead of Gidon, Yerubbaal. Yorev Bo HaBaal. That's short for Yorev Bo HaBaal. May the Baal fight him. And that was a way of appeasing the people. Don't worry, the Baal will take care of it. But in essence, he wanted to save his son from the people. Yeah?
So this is kind of highlighting detail. So that would mean it is okay, or supposing it is okay for the father to avenge the son's death, if somebody were to kill him. Now, on that point, just reminded me, how far do we take that? I mean, today, I assume that we're not really practicing this, but if somebody
any issue that has to do with life and death has to be asked of someone bigger than me. Sorry. So on that day, Gidon was given the nickname of Yerubbaal. Now the Midianites and Amalek and all these tribes of the east gathered, and they're camping in a place that's going to become famous later in history called Emek Yisrael. And God gave Gidon extra strength and courage, and he blew shofar, and he gathered his father's family, Aviezer, they're following him. And he sends word throughout the tribe of Menashe, and you recall Menashe is a huge tribe. Half of Menashe is on the eastern side of the Jordan, and half of Menashe is in the land of Israel. And he gathers the tribe of Menashe, and he sends word to the tribes of Asher, Zvon, and Naphtali, the tribes of the north. And they gather together, they're ready to take on the Midianites. And then Gidon turns to God. He has this small army. We're going to see that his army in total, they numbered...
at the end,
right, that's at the end. His army right now numbers 32,000 people. And we're going to see that the Midianites number much, much more. The Midianites outnumber them maybe 10 to 1, if not more. And so Gidon is a little bit scared. And he says, God, if you're going to save the Jews like you told me, so I want a sign. I'm going to take a piece of wool and I'll put it in the granary. And tomorrow morning, if there'll be dew on the piece of wool alone and no dew all around on the earth, then I'll know you'll save the Jews by me. So he wakes up the next morning and the piece of wool is filled with dew. He squeezes it out and he fills a whole cup filled with water. But God wasn't going to listen to him and make the dew stop raining all around earth just because he's asking for a sign. So he gets half his wish. The wool is filled with water, but God still makes dew fall around the rest of planet Earth, because God promised the Earth that there's going to be dew, because all the plants need dew in order to be sustained. So Gideon says, God, please don't be upset with me, but I just want to ask for one more sign. Tomorrow morning, let there be dew all around the piece of wool and no dew on the wool. So that's what happened. The next morning, there's dew all around and the piece of wool is dry as can be. So Gideon gets the sign. He gets up early and he takes his people with him, and they're headed towards the Midianite camp. The Midianites are in the north, and their camp extends. You have to go over many cities to cover all of their camp. Their camp extends over quite a few cities. And God tells Gideon, you have too many people. I don't want the Jews to think they won by virtue of their might. So tell the people, whoever is scared should get up early in the morning when no one can tell who's leaving, and they should go to the mountaintop of Gilead. Now they should go back home. So early the next morning, 22,000 people leave camp. So these were pretty amazing people. They were scared and they were ready to go to war. He's left with 10,000, and they're even more amazing, because these 10,000 figure, when they numbered 32,000, 22,000 were scared. Now that they're down to 10,000, these 10 are sticking around. Yeah. No. Yep. Okay. So God tells Gideon, you still have too many people. Take them down to the water, and over there I'll decide who yeah and who no. We'll purify them there. So the nation goes down to the water, and they go to drink. Some of them bow down before the water to drink, and others lie down and prick up the water, or they cup the water in their hands and drink. And God says, those that bow before the water are accustomed to bowing before the pagan gods, they can't join the camp. Take only those that lay down next to the water and cup the water in their hands and drink. A note aside, halachically you're not supposed to drink directly from water, because we say there could be vermin in the water that could harm a person. There could be a snake there. There could be poison. You should drink only from water that's running. And even then, you're supposed to take the water out of the body of water and drink it so that you can see what you're drinking. You're not supposed to drink when you can't see what you're drinking. You put your mouth at the end of a pipe, and like at lifta, water's coming out. You don't know what's coming in, and you're just drinking blindly because you figure the water that came till now was clean. I guess no snake coming down, nothing else coming down that water. No, you're supposed to take the water out either in your hand or in something else and drink from it that way. So these 300 people, 300 meaning we're down to 300 people. 9,700 of the 10,000 are disqualified. They've all been serving idols. And these are the faithful people who are willing to go with Gideon against all odds. And nonetheless, God says, nope, no good. So Gideon tells his 300 men, you take the shofarot, the shofar, from the other 9,700 men. Each person should have a shofar and take their food, and we'll go to attack. And that night, God tells Gideon, you're going to win. So they look down, there are 300 men on top of the hilltop, and they look down at a camp that extends as far as they can see. As far down as you can see, there are Midianites. You can't see the end of their camp. So just imagine how many hundreds of thousands of soldiers were there camped with their camels. And if you're scared, so God, we can understand Gideon's going to be scared. 300, they're outnumbered maybe 100 to 1. God tells them, if you're scared, so take your lad, go down to the camp, and you'll hear what the people are saying, and then you'll have strength. Okay.
Rob, I was just thinking, there's a story which seems to be taken exactly from this. The story of the 300 Spartans and 300,000 Greeks.
There are many stories. The more you learn, the more you'll see that.
The movie 300, it was like, it's like, it's just a copy of this. Exactly a copy of this.
Where do you think the whole story of Oedipus comes from? Chazal also. There are many stories. The more you learn, the more you'll see how many stories were taken from our heritage. Oedipus.
What is it in the Midrash that we hear about Pur? Or there was one of
Pura?
Yeah.
So I said he's going with Pura, his lad. Gideon and Pura, the lad. Pura is his name.
Okay.
So they go down to the camp, and Gideon comes and they listen to the guards, and one guard tells the other guard, I dreamt a dream, and in my dream there was this hot cake, this cake that's made on coals, and it was rolling in the camp of Midian, and it came to a tent, knocked down the tent. Now that's unusual, a piece of cake rolls down up to a tent and then knocks down the tent. Now we know that in order to plant bread, in order to have cake, you have to plant, you have to stay in one place and harvest the crops and make cake. And we know that the Jews on Pesach, they start harvesting their flour. They start harvesting the grains on Pesach. So for the Jews, Jews are represented by that cake. And the Midianite camp, we said the Midianites were nomads, so they're represented by the tent. And the fact that a little cake overtook a tent represents the fact that Gideon has a small army compared to the Midianites that have like a huge tent against the cake. It's against all odds that a cake will knock down a tent. But he's telling him, against all odds, they're going to win. So his friend tells him, that must be the sword of Gideon, the important man of Israel. God must have given the camp of Midian and in his hands. And when Gideon heard the dream and the explanation, he bowed before God. Because we have on tradition that every dream goes after its interpretation. Once a dream is interpreted, so that's the way it's going to be. A person can have a dream in which he loses his feet. And he goes to his friend, and his friend tells him, it must mean you're going to be very wealthy, you're going to have a Cadillac from now on, you won't have to use your feet anymore. And that interpretation will come true. The Gemara tells a story. Story like that, a guy dreamt he lost his feet, he went to his friend told him, it means you're going to be rich, you're not going to have to walk anywhere, you're going to have horses and servants and everything, and that's exactly what happened. The Gemara tells us a dream goes after its interpretation. So that's why the best thing when you have a dream is not to tell anyone, keep quiet, because you never know what they'll tell you. But if you're going to tell someone, so tell someone who really knows this Gemara, knows how to interpret well, but you're better off not telling. The Gemara says, if you don't tell, it won't happen. So, and most dreams come from indigestion. So nowadays, what? Indigestion. Because you ate food before you went to sleep, and then you're not digesting it well during your sleep. That's why you're dreaming a bad dream.
Yeah? What does the Torah say in the second world, the genetic sense is that dreams are an attempt of your subconscious to deal with your problem?
Thursday night, there's a lot to discuss about that. We have, if you want, in the question and answer section, we have a whole section about dreams. And if you want to discuss it, I'll be happy to discuss it on Thursday night. It deserves more than a 1 minute answer. But there's definitely Chazal, let's say it. Yeah. But Chazal explained it a little differently. So Gideon divides his camp in three, and each one has a trumpet, and each one has a torch, and they put their torches inside earthenware vessels, which was their form of disposables. Earthenware was very cheap, it was easy to come by, so that was their disposable vessels. And he says, you guys do just like me. I'm going to come to the edge of camp and blow my shofar, and everyone with me will blow their shofar, and you guys will blow your shofars, and you'll declare, we are here for God, and Gideon is our leader. And they come, Gideon comes with his 100 men to the edge of the camp, and they're there just at midnight. They're just changing the watch, the guard, and they blow their shofar, they bash their earthenware pots, and they're standing there blowing the shofar. Now there are a bunch of torches in the middle of the Midianite camp, and on three fronts the Midianites hear these. Each side they hear 100 shofar blasts, and they hear the declaration, the sword is here on behalf of God, with the leader is Gideon. And the people just stood there, and the camp started running. You have three different camps or more. You have the Midianites, the Amalek, and then Bnei Kedem, and they're convinced that they're being attacked. Now the Jews don't even enter the camp, but God made it that the people were so confused, waking up in the middle of the night to all this light, and they're running, and they see one another, and each one thinks that the other one is the enemy, so they fight. And the Midianites were killing one another, and the Jewish tribes, when they saw that Gideon was winning, so they gave chase as well. Gideon sent word to the tribe of Ephraim, capture the water, the place where people would cross the water, so that the Midianites don't have places to cross or get water from. And they capture the two heads of Midian, Orev and Zeev, and they kill them. And now the war hasn't yet concluded, but there's going to be an internal struggle. The tribe of Ephraim, who joined the chase and destroyed the two kings of Midian, they come to Gideon and they say, what are you doing? You start a war and you don't let us know you're starting a war? Don't you know you're endangering all of the Jewish people? What chutzpah is this? You start a war and you don't even let us know. And Gideon is faced with the challenge of first appeasing the people from within before he can continue his war from without, because he has not yet finished his war against the Midianites. The Midianites are still a looming threat. He has them on the run. But before he can continue his chase, he has to deal with the internal struggle that the tribe of Ephraim, who are people who can easily turn against him, are coming to him with a very harsh claim. How did you start this war without letting us know? Now that you need our help, suddenly he tells, okay, go capture the waterways. But why didn't you let us know before you started the war? What's going on here? And this is where we'll pick up, Ezrat Hashem, after Yom Kippur, next semester. Ezrat Hashem, we'll pick up over here.
What are they-